You're listening to Upfront. I'm Antonia Yuhas. We're joined today by writer, sailor, and conservationist Jonathan White. He's written for the Christian Science Monitor, Sierra, The Sun, Surfer's Journal, Orion, and many other publications. His first book is Talking on the Water, Conversations about Nature and Creativity. His latest book is called Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean. I became aware of it because it won the Society of Environmental Journalists honorable mention for its Rachel Carson's Environmental Book Award. Thanks for joining us today, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me.
And tell us again where you are, where you're joining us from right now.
A very small island north of Seattle, just south of the Canadian border. It's in the San Juan Islands. I've lived here for about 25 years.
So surrounded by water.
That's right.
Go ahead and read us a section from Tides.
Okay. This is from the second chapter, and it takes place at Mont-Saint-Michel in Normandy, France. And this is a chapter in which I'm talking about kind of the ancient history, mythological history about the tides. And this is a monastery where monks and sisters live and have dedicated their lives to the study of spirituality and God, of course. So I went there in part because there's a very large tide, but also because I wanted to interview the monks about their relationship with the tide and spirituality. So this is in preparation for that interview. I know tomorrow I will meet with the monks, but tonight I ponder a letter sent earlier from Brother Francois Marie. The abbey, he wrote, is a jewel set in a beautiful case, the bay. Isn't beauty a language through which God and mankind want to meet? If beauty is a language, then Mont-Saint-Michel is well spoken tonight. At the western ramparts, where a couple of hours ago I had watched the flood tides advancing wave, I now study the ebb tide's fingers withdrawing in the inky light. I'm struck at the different voices I hear in the tide and the monastery. The abbey speaks of human achievement, built painstakingly in service to the Archangel Michael, a guardian and dragon slayer. The monument is an eloquent testament to humanity's insatiable desire for connection and belonging to God, to nature, to other humans. The stone heft speaks of permanence, a longing for the eternal. The tide is another kind of eloquence. It's the moon's voice on earth, spoken in perfect synchrony. What the moon does, the tide does. What the moon is, the tide is. Shifting by day but repeating a larger pattern, the tide mirrors the moon's paradox of change and changelessness. In its repetition, it personifies eternity. In its constant flux, it reminds us of what we can't control. It reminds us that our fortresses are impermanent.
Thank you for reading that section. And this is our guest, Jonathan White, joining us and just reading a section from his book, Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean. And what's so beautiful about that section is actually part of the mysteriousness of tides that I did not realize until reading your book. And it is a really beautiful lyrical work that carries that motion of the ocean through it, through your writing. So thank you for such a both informative and really beautiful piece of writing. I think the thing that I found most new to me was the mysteriousness of tides. And one of the things that you write that I found really fascinating was oceans listening, oceans hearing, as you write, different heavenly calls in different ways, that the Atlantic is strongly tuned to the moon, but the Pacific is more tuned to the sun, and that the ocean is listening with different ears to different voices influencing the tides. Can you talk more about that?
Tide is really vibration. it's or resonance when something vibrates in response to something else. So the oceans vibrate or resonate with these different calls from the gravitational pulls of the sun and the moon. That's really the essence of it. It's about vibration. And so that's what you're talking about, what you picked up in the book. And it is fascinating. And it is very poetic, I think, in a lot of ways, because you can think of it as music from the sun and the moon, all the different pulses, all the different rhythms and beats. And the ocean basins of the world respond differently to those beats. Some of them very enthusiastically, like the Atlantic and the Pacific and the Bay of Fundy, and some of them don't respond very well at all, like the Gulf of Mexico or the Baltic or Mediterranean.
And you also said that the idea of predicting and understanding the tides and therefore is also mysterious, in that you quoted one very accomplished oceanographer, David Greenberg, who said, you know, I don't have aha moments in this field, only oh God moments when I find something makes no sense. Why is it so difficult to predict or, I guess, interpret the movement of the tides?
I think it's just because there are so many factors involved. I mean, like, for example, when we talked about the so-called calls from the universe, from the sun and the moon, there are over 400 different rhythms of the sun and the moon that have been identified that have some kind of tide signature on Earth. So some of those rhythms are ones we commonly know, like the full moon or new moon or the sun overhead or the sun closest to the Earth in January and furthest from the Earth in July. There are a lot of different of these rhythms that are common to us, right? But then there are also rhythms that are less common. Like there's a 20,000 year rhythm of the precession of the equinoxes, which is the slight little wobble in the Earth. You know, when you spin a top, there's a little bit of a wobble, and that's a 20,000 year cycle, again called the precession of the equinoxes, and it has a tide signature on Earth. It's very small, but it does. So there are many, many, many factors at work, and that's just what's happening in the sky. But then the other part of it, what's happening, how the oceans are responding, and the deep oceans respond fairly regularly. You know, there's an 18-inch tide in the deep ocean, and 12 inches of that is due to the moon, and 6 inches is due to the sun. But as soon as that tide crosses onto the shallow water of the continental shelves and deeper into the coastal areas, it gets infinitely complex, because there's rocks and reefs and shallow water. The tide folds back on itself. It stands. It doubles up. It does all kinds of things. It gets out of phase. So in order to understand what's happening in any one place, you have to just unpack all the variables in that place. And you can understand it. But it may not be the same kind of tide and the same kind of factors at work if you move 10 miles down the coast.
And you talk about traveling all over the world, and in particular coastal communities that, of course, are deeply dependent for all parts of their life and existence on the movement of the tides, and that there are all sorts of different belief systems in different communities about what moves the tides and how to respond to that. Can you talk about some of those journeys that you went on?
One of the themes, of course, is the spiritual theme. And for example, I went to the San Blas Islands off of the coast of Panama on the east side. And there's about 350 of these very small, low-lying coral islands that spread almost all the way down to Colombia. And they're occupied by the Cunayala Indians. And they've been there for about 250 years. And again, these are very low-lying islands. And there's a tide there of about 10 to 12 inches. And but these are so low-lying islands that these people live basically with the tide at their ankles all the time. And they have two views about the tide. One of them is a traditional view that tells them that the tide is a spiritual visitor from another dimension come to check up on the village. And so when it comes in, as it does on any coast, it's checking on the village. And if it finds that everything is okay, it stays. If it finds that everything's okay, it recedes like it does anywhere else. But if it finds that things are not okay spiritually with the village, it stays. So that's a view about sea level rise and rising tides for them, that this is a spiritual problem. But they also have sober-minded scientists within their community that tells them that if tides rise 3 feet in the next 50 years, as they're conservatively estimated to do in that area, that they will lose all their island homes and they'll have to find another place to live. So they entertain both those views. And they're looking for a place, a new place to live, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I found that was that those kinds of views were prevalent all over the world, especially in indigenous communities.
And so there is then this, as the final chapter of the book is entitled Higher Tides, there is this obviously realization that the tide is rising and encroaching more and more on communities, that, and particularly indigenous communities that have spent their lives dependent on and interdependent with the ocean. And so what are some of the, you know, changes that are happening in those communities where the tide is rising? And as you say, these plans for, you know, moving, having to move a community that's been there for centuries somewhere else.
Yes. And, you know, of course, we're all aware of the changing sea levels that are happening, especially exaggerated in the last 50 years or so due to homogenic reasons. And, you know, as the sea levels rise, it will change the tide. It is changing the tide, actually, but it's a very complex system. And in fact, as the sea levels rise, it will change the resonant quality of these basins. So some basins will become more resonant. In other words, they'll have larger tides, and some basins might become less resonant and lesser tides. But it's a very hard thing to predict, and scientists are trying to model it now, and eventually we will. But sea levels are rising so fast, and modeling just can't keep up with it. So we're going to, you know, the next, you know, number of years ahead of us, we're going to see a lot of changes along the coastline, and it's not fully predictable what those will be. Even sea level rise, of course, itself is not that predictable. But I think it's also interesting to remember that sea level is you know, the sea isn't level, right? And it's never been level. So for over geological time, the seas are always changing. For example, 14,000 years ago, our oceans were about 450 feet lower than they are today, you know, due to the water being locked up in glaciers. And about 19 million years ago, it was about 170 feet higher than it is today. So as those sea levels change over time, it affects the tides, and we see all kinds of new and changing dynamics along the coastline.
Well, maybe the question then to ask is to back up and talk about terms. So I think most of us understand what it means for the sea level to rise, but what exactly then is a tide, and what does it mean for it to come in and come out at different, you know, a different strength and times and consistencies?
Yeah. So sea level is kind of the fundamental that underlies all the tides. And of course, the tides happen really on top of sea level. You know, it's in other words, the tides are coming and going pretty much daily. And from an astronomical or scientific point of view, the tide is really daily and seasonal changes in sea level due to astronomical factors, okay, it's due to the sun and the moon. Now, that's the fundamental theory, but also broadly, the tides are influenced a lot by daily and seasonal weather patterns. And a lot of people don't know that, but for example, the NOAA is the entity that's responsible for creating in issuing tide charts. And they do it, by the way, by harmonic analysis, which it circles back to this idea of resonance, right, mm-hmm. that we were talking about. So the NOAA uses resonance to determine what the tides are going to be. And it's down to a science. They get very, very accurate reports. But what they can't report is what happens day to day and seasonally with the weather. So if we get a weather pattern coming through a low pressure system, for example, that has less pressure on the ocean surface, the surface tends to bulge up, right? And it can bulge up to 30 feet with a big storm. And then you have a tide on top of that. You could have tides that are 300-500% larger than normal on any day. For example, that's what happened with Katrina and Sandy. But you could also have a really high pressure day, a bright, sunny, high pressure day that presses down on the ocean. So the tide would be 2-3 feet less than what the tide charts predicted. Hmm. So winds can bring the tide in faster and larger, or if the wind is against the tide, it can push it back so it actually doesn't happen at all. So there are all kinds of conditions that are changing with the weather. And of course, that's a day-to-day experience. But on the long-term picture, as the Earth changes, as we see global warming, as the oceans warm, that's also changing. It's changing the tides because, of course, the ocean is bulging up because it's warming, and it's also rising because of melting glaciers and global warming. So lots and lots of changes, lots of levels to look at. I always love Rachel Carson's quote where she said, today – a little more land belongs to the ocean, tomorrow a little less.
But when many of us discuss climate change, the phrase we actually use is climate chaos. That's what is happening, is that we are throwing the weather system into a chaotic, unpredictable set of patterns that are becoming more extreme as they become more chaotic. And then doesn't all of those changes that you're saying, that you've described, are ways that the impact on the tides would be also become more chaotic. And is that something then that coastline communities are having to deal with, which is a phenomena that they've grown accustomed to over centuries and have different, as you've described, fascinating spiritual beliefs about the connection to the tide and what the tide means. You quote, which I found really beautiful, different stories from the Maori of New Zealand and different stories from the Chinese stories and just from all over the world. But now that is changing, and that's got to be exceptionally difficult on those coastal communities, not just that the sea is rising, but the unpredictability of the tides.
What makes this particularly challenging today is just the level of development along the coast, and population. Because, 300-500 years ago, as sea levels changed, you just grabbed your cows and you moved up to higher ground, mm-hmm. But we've overdeveloped our coastlines and overpopulated them. And so consequently, again, this is not a new issue, but because we have so much at stake, it becomes so much more an intense issue. But, there is an inevitability about change and about not being able to predict change. And I think that's a reality that's just always been true. But there's just more at stake today.
And my guest again is Jonathan White, and his latest book is Tides, the Science and Spirit of the Ocean. Can you talk about a key takeaway for you from writing this book, from going on this journey?
One of them was that, I think we're all longing for connection, that's kind of the heart of, what we all are trying to do on this planet in a lot of different ways. And in fact, Steinbeck said in the log of the Sea of Cortez, which was, a journey in 1939 with Steinbeck and Ed Ricketts to to collect intertidal creatures in Baja California, and their book, The Log of the Sea Cortez, is a seminal piece of writing about philosophy and ecology and ocean oceanography and so forth. But I think what he said was, isn't all of our what we call spirituality really a longing for connection? And it's important then to look into the tide pool and look into the stars and then back again. So I think what he was saying was that, you know, to see this interconnectedness right in front of us. And he happened to pick the tide pool, and they had this concept called the Great Tide Pool, which I think is really that they were able to see all this interconnectedness right there in front of them, and yet it was part of a larger process that was being influenced by the sun and the moon and the whole solar system.
And I think that's such a profound concept, because one of the things that drew me to the book was, you know, we are increasingly as a species treating the ocean as a garbage dump, as a place to leave trash and to abuse at our own peril. And to understand much more clearly in all the ways that we can our profound connection to the ocean, and also its necessity to our existence on this planet, and to, you know, remember that connection. And I think the tides, as you so beautifully articulate, are one of the ways that we feel that most profoundly. And I actually really did love when you talked about the Maori of New Zealand believe that the tides rose and fell at the whim of a woman god who lived on the moon. The Chinese envisioned the Milky Way as a great water wheel filling and emptying the oceans. It churned. In many cultures, as this gets back to what you just said, there was a perceived secret harmony between the tide and human life. And I think that's something that we all feel when we are near the ocean. And I really appreciated your book really bringing that home in both a scientific and spiritual way through the writing. So thank you so much for writing it, and thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Antonia.
My guest again was Jonathan White, and the book is Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean.